Real pleasure to be here today, and I have an entire presentation mapped out, which I'm going to jettison for the first 5 minutes because my real ambition in life is to annotate and comment upon what John Udell has inspired me to think about. And Janet also had a great piece of this just now in a kind of, this is what we do, right? I mean, we talk to each other. We share these thoughts. Things emerge from our conversations. This is not unlike what is happening online. It's very rapid and it's very intimate in a face-to-face setting, but you can have that same experience online in teaching and learning in ways that persist and that people outside the immediate time and space can participate in. That's part of what makes it so exciting for me, because my students experience the classroom as a container. I talked about this last year, and I want them to experience the classroom as an experience, not as something that is a bucket, but something that prepares them to be part of a knowledge community. So I just want to take the first couple of minutes here to think about this idea of intuitions, because the question, I think, has been raised, does this mean that the use of the tools is intuitive? I don't think so. No tool that we build for ourselves conceptually is intuitive. An alphabet is not intuitive. It just isn't. If I make a shape that looks like a letter A and I just show it to someone who has no idea what an alphabet is, what would you do with that? You would say, oh, that's interesting. It's a shape. It looks sort of like, I don't know, is that a teepee? Is it an arrow? What do I do with that? But once we've mastered these principles, oh, that stands for a sound, that maps onto something we do when we speak, and now this is something we do when we write, now we can use it. Now we can think about it. Now we can have intuitions about it. If you can make a word C-A-T, I wonder if you can make a word D-O-G. Yes. Now you're on your way to being a reader. And for me, the idea of intuition is not the idea that these tools are simply going to reveal their uses or their nature to you automatically. They're not, I don't think. What I think of when I think of intuitions is what I struggle with my students. My students don't understand the range of questions possible to them. That's another way of saying they don't even know what to be curious about. And I have found this over and over with things that absolutely baffle me. For example, they will regularly skip the introduction to a novel. Absolutely. Now, sometimes they do that because they don't want the critic to, you know, set up the reading for them. They want their own. I understand that. But let's say it's the author's introduction, or let's say it's an epigraph, or let's say it's the fact that it's not a novel but a romance. They don't ask questions about that, which is very striking to me. Just recently in a class I'm teaching, which is a class in New Media Studies, I played a video by Alan Kay, who really is the inventor of, let's say, the laptop, an idea of personal computing that's been very, very influential. He really invented the whole Windows style of interface. Big, big guy in the history of computing. And I showed them a video in which, at the very beginning, Alan Kay, a poobah if there ever was one, says, this is a great example of XYZ, right? And I asked my students to think about the video and begin to respond to it. Not a one of them thought about the example he had introduced at the beginning, introduced with high praise, the highest praise possible. Alan Kay is kind of a grouchy guy now. He's not profligate with his praise. There should have been a huge attention marker for all of my students at the very beginning. Listen to this. Take note of this. No one did. And I asked them later, why weren't you curious about that? Why didn't you ask a question about that? I tried to do it in a very friendly way, of course. I didn't have my teacher stern look. And they said to me, this is very interesting, we simply assumed that the beginning wouldn't be important. I said, why did you assume that? Well, as most things get underway in our world, they said, the beginning of it is just kind of, you know, roughage. Nothing much is happening. Everybody's just kind of settling down. We wouldn't think about paying attention to that. So they didn't have an intuition about the materials I would present in a class, and I have to wonder, what has the classroom taught them not to ask? What has the classroom taught them not to be curious about? Maybe they were expecting the day's announcements at the beginning of the class, you know? So they weren't curious about my presentation of the material. In a fundamental way, they weren't curious about the material itself because they assumed something about the beginning of anything that you would watch. There were so many assumptions built in, or to put it in the language that John shared with us, so many intuition blockers, because they didn't think that there was meaning or significance or anything to ask a question about right there. And as I interpret what John is, and I've got him right here so I can check my interpretations against the author, which is something that they train us not to do as English grad students, right? But I don't care about that. I think authors matter. As I interpret it, computational thinking is a way of asking, no, let me put it another way, is a way of teaching what questions are possible in the computational domain, developing those intuitions that if I have a thing that's a spreadsheet, maybe it's not just a spreadsheet. Maybe it's a jumping off point to think about data this way in another domain. How do you generate those questions? I think it really does get down to principles. So this is where Janet comes in. Janet was talking to me just now, and she could have tweeted this. I'll probably tweet it or blog about it later because I want to share it with people. Who do I want to share it with? Anybody who wants to see it. Do I have to identify all those people? No, they can identify themselves. That's this publication subscription model. And she said, why don't you start with metacognition? And I thought, yeah, okay. This is a term that is well understood in the educational community. It's thinking about thinking. Metacognition is something that we do naturally, but until we're aware that we do it, we can't use it as a tool. So the idea is, how do you, in this computing domain, awaken certain kinds of metacognition so that students are not using these tools as just hammers to drive nails or just a taxi cab to get them from InfoSpace A to InfoSpace B? How do we get students, how do we get ourselves to think about all this stuff that's out on the web as an alphabet? Something we can spell with, something that's a language, a medium we can use and we can think about as we're using it. We don't have to be computer programmers to do that. We simply have to be thoughtful about possibilities and push ourselves out to find out what questions will make sense in this space. And that's really kind of a difficult thing to do, it turns out. But I'll start with this. Maybe I'll get back to my presentation in a moment. We'll start shortly. This is Twitter. This is using an affordance that's not part of Twitter. It's actually something somebody developed to help people use Twitter better. Twitter did not invent this. Twitter.com is not this. Twitter has made itself open to people asking questions about how could I use Twitter better. And Twitter says, we don't know. How could you use Twitter better? And people say, oh, I bet I could do something. And then they do it. This is part of what this expanding universe is all about. And you can see here, I've got a column on the left, which is everyone I'm subscribing to, everyone I'm following. The column in the middle there is everyone who's directing something right at me in response to something I have said, I have tweeted. And then on the far right, I am searching on the tag, the information marker. This is everything that has this particular conference hashtag on it. You can see a number of things. I've taken notes on what happened during John's talk. They're all available because they're tagged, and they'll stay there. How long, we don't know, but they're there for now. All right. Everyone who responds to something I have tweeted comes up in the replies column. And then the ongoing conversation in the world of the people I follow is there on the left. Now, something interesting and strange happens. First of all, I give up the idea that I'm going to look at everything on the left. I can't do it. First of all, I'm not at my computer all the time. Even I am not at my computer all the time. I'll just say that. All right? Second, I don't want to read it all. I can't. I can't pay attention to that many things. However, there are, in the course of the day, opportunities for me just to scan the list, anything interesting there, what are my friends doing, what are my friends saying, and it turns out that the people in my network, sometimes they talk about their cats, which is interesting to me if I know them personally. Most of the time they're sharing resources, they're sharing ideas from in the moment, and it turns out that when they share those things in the moment, there's a certain sparkle to them. This gets very soft and squishy, so I apologize. There's something about what it's like being there in that moment and tweeting that I think in many respects overcomes our self-editing. That can be disastrous sometimes, but stay with me. It can actually push things out that we might not think about pushing out otherwise because it's very easy, it's very quick, and you share it, and you don't know who's going to find that useful. As I was taking notes on John's presentation, people began to join the conversation in two ways. Down at the bottom, you can see the first thing that started to happen. See these RTs here? That stands for retweet. That means that someone in my network found something that I was reporting on interesting, and then they tweeted it. Now, you can say, why would they do that? Isn't that just sending back what you just sent them? No, our networks are like Venn diagrams, right? Their network is not exactly identical with mine because they're following different people, probably from the ones I'm following and so forth. What happened here is that somebody caught that thought and pushed it along into their network. Now, if you're following me, and here's the metacognitive affordance, that's a learning community assembling itself on the fly. It's what we want our students to do. Catch the thought from me, from each other, from something you read, from something someone said at home, from something that somebody said on the bus. Catch that thought, push it along. It's a very playful way to interact. It's purposeful too, and you can't control it. You shouldn't try to shape it too narrowly. There are other things we can do for that. The term paper is not going away. The research project is not going away. But I can tell you from my own experience that when you're using tools like this, that pushing the thought along actually lends a kind of vividness, a kind of energy, a sense of shared purpose to whatever you're doing in a learning situation. It is quite remarkable. At one point, the retweets stopped. Well, they didn't stop, but in the midst of the retweets, this person decided to respond. Something I had said about what John had said about intuition caught her eye. Now she's not just retweeting it, she's entering in the conversation. The conversation at the pre-conference workshop at USEA 2009. She's not involved in continuing education. She's not in this room. I have not met her face to face. You could say that she is as disconnected as she could be. And yet, something about what you all are creating in this conference together right now is starting to expand, to widen its significance in more or less real time through some small sector of the world. This too is like teaching. We all know this. Something you say to the kid in the back of the room who looks like he or she is bored out of his or her skull in that moment could change, reshape some part of that person's thinking. That person will talk to somebody else. That person will talk to somebody else. That person may sign up for your class next term. That person heard something about the class. Now that person's thought becomes part of the network. This is very exciting to any teacher, it seems to me. And when it's online, you have the tremendous advantage that you can see it, it persists, you can talk about it in a room like this, you can begin to see what we've always done in conversation, what we've always done when we're really engaged as learners, but now it's out there. You can see it, you can build on it, and the effects can expand because you're exposing what you're doing to the network effects. Network effects are another name for civilization, conversation. This amplifies it. And at one point, when I was talking about this intuition thing in my notes during John's presentation, I was so fascinated by this. Apparently, Mishugana, which is a great username, somebody is writing a dissertation on great usernames right now, because this, what a wonderful opportunity it is to, you know, sort of name yourself again. My name is simply Gardner Campbell because I lacked imagination at that point of contact. But Mishugana said, needed for developing intuition is learning to observe and think creatively using heart as well as mind. We know this is true. We know this is why people read. We know this is why people learn. The heart is not detached from the mind, and that doesn't have to be squishy. The heart doesn't mean, oh, I love it, pass the orange, you know, hug my teddy. The heart means that it matters, that it's meaningful, not just relevant in an empty way, but you can sense its significance. You can sense that you're plugged into something bigger than you are. And then she said, Holmes to Watson. And we've all read Sherlock Holmes, I think most of us, right? Holmes to Watson. You see, but you do not observe. Blow up textbooks and pay strict attention. Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting observation for me, because when you think about intuition, when you think about metacognition, when you think about critical thinking, so much of that has to do with helping our students understand what it's like to pay attention, to really observe something, not to be passive. That even listening is a kind of ferocious activity if you're really following along. You know what that's like when you go to a concert, right? If you just kind of let it wash over you like Muzak, what's that about? But if you follow along as if you were playing the instrument yourself, whether you can play or not, if you really follow the music the way you would try to read a favorite novel, now you're inside of it. Now you're observing. Now you're paying strict attention. And believe me, questions will emerge from that. This is so exciting. I could talk about this a long time. Oh, okay. over here in the search, which is bringing all the hashtags in, SZPAC, I'm not sure who that is, retweeted something that I tweeted from John. Twitter thoughts pushed out with hashtags, don't stop when conference stops. And then he adds his little note, tweet of the day for me. Now I feel good about that. John feels good about that. SZPAC feels good about that. You all ought to feel good about it, because if it wasn't for this occasion, us together at this moment, John wouldn't have spoken, I wouldn't have tweeted, you wouldn't be here, we wouldn't share this moment together. But we did, and here it is. And we can go back, we can see this later. We can think about it more, keep the hashtag going. What teacher would, whether it's Twitter or not, it doesn't really matter. What matters is, here's an opportunity. Here's something that happens when we're in this medium that really is like what we've always done, but with an unprecedented kind of amplification. So, I guess I should go ahead and start my presentation. So, let me show you something I think is not disruptive. I bet you've seen it. I've got some fun Star Trek stuff here, which I have to skip. I'm sorry. I know. If it doesn't have Star Trek, it's not a real presentation. I bet you all have seen this, all right? I'm going to put the mic down so you can hear it, too. How many of you have seen this?
I stand before you today to apologize. The system has failed you. I have failed you. I have failed to help you share your talent with the world, and the world needs talent more than ever, yet it's being wasted every day by an educational system steeped in tradition and old ideas. It's time for a new tradition.
It's time to realize talent isn't just in schools like this one. It's everywhere.
It's time to use technology to rewrite the rules of education.
So learn how you learn so we can teach you better.
It's time university adapted to you rather than you adapting to it.
It's time
for a different,
different kind of university. It's your time.
All right, I'm going to make the case that that is not at all disruptive. It may have some minor usefulness. I think a great lecture is a great thing. I'm somewhat of a maverick in that regard out in this space. I've heard great lectures. I struggle to give them myself. But it is not disruptive simply to package them so people can see them on their iPods or their computer screens. It's so ironic to me that it's your time. We're going to rewrite the rules. But there are no rules rewritten in that commercial. The students are sitting there, listening, watching. This is disruptive. The commercial is downloaded from the Kaplan site, posted to YouTube, and people talk back. Wow, I can't believe people are buying into this. It sounds nice until the end. What makes Kaplan any different? What makes Kaplan not part of the failed education system? What, because you can watch videos instead and pay 1,000 times more for them? Does that make it not a part of the failed system? I think Kaplan should make a commercial explaining that. Now, I bet the marketing people at Kaplan didn't count on having feedback Certainly not feedback like that. We were just supposed to watch and go, oh yeah, oh yeah. Now it gets even better. Wow, James Avery has aged. Was watching Fresh Prince and then this commercial pops up and saw how much he changed. Great, though, how he lost weight and can still act very well. Oh, it turns out he's not a real teacher at all. Talk about filtering information. Talk about being critical about sources of information. So Kaplan makes this really good, feel-good commercial and they cast somebody from Central Casting and everybody on YouTube recognizes. This is Uncle Phil from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. The next comment, Uncle Phil! Why did Kaplan University get Uncle Phil for a commercial? Uncle Phil is awesome! More comments. I am young. I teach mostly lazy students in a traditional university setting. Most students like my class, but they would serve themselves well by trying just a little harder to adapt to the university. They might learn a valuable skill, developing a work ethic. Now, you'll notice that Saturn 11 has a +6 next to Saturn 11. YouTube allow, and I have to be candid about this, the comment stream in YouTube is, let's just say it is not a clear and pearl-like comment stream. It's a pretty industrial kind of comment stream. That is to say, it's everything from LOL and profanity to people actually trying to comment. But there's a system where you can rank the usefulness of the comment. And enough people said, yeah, this is good, it goes up to +6. I don't think Kaplan had that in mind. And then user is an FBI agent. Who knows who this is? The more I teach myself online, the more they advertise on my 5-foot DLP TV, LOL. Maybe I'll give them a call or whatever. IDK, meaning I don't know. I so didn't like school and I so do not have any money. Well, that comment didn't get very high rating. But here's the point. Kaplan believes it's transformational. Kaplan pitched itself as transformational. And to be fair, a lot of us in higher education believe, oh, if we just digitize it and put it on a website somewhere, we're being disruptive. You know, we're really, you know, breaking down the boundaries. Well, I'm not going to say that's not at all valuable, but it's not what I would call disruption, not genuine disruption. Putting the video up on YouTube and getting the straight, unvarnished stuff from everyone, from Saturn 11 to user is an FBI agent, although it's overwhelming, although I don't need to read stuff like user is an FBI agent, it is disruptive because that kind of feedback and that kind of wrenching something out of context and making it a two-way conversation is not exactly what we had in mind. This is disruptive. This is a chip. It's a microchip. And before I get real geeky on this, how many of you have iPhones? Yeah. How many of you love your iPhones? Yeah. It tends to win, so yeah, okay, right. My name is Gardner. I have an iPhone. I've hurt many people with this habit. This is a chip that's going to be coming out in a couple of years, which will have 8 times the power of an iPhone. It will be able to record and stream out high-definition video, equivalent to Blu-ray discs right now. You can see the other stats there. A 20-megapixel camera, 130 hours of audio playback. I guarantee you that people who have this are not going to be using it simply to store videos of Uncle Phil in a Kaplan commercial. What should happen is that these portable devices should be ways for our students to become active learners. By being creative with the way they push out to record and share their research, their own creativity, their own responses, reflectively, not with LOLs and IDKs, unless that's called for. Now, where did I find out about this chip? There's a fellow named Adrian Cockcroft who works for Netflix. And he's also a computer developer. He's got a blog called Millicomputing, and a Millicomputer is a computer that consumes less than 1 watt of power and will not burn your leg if you have it in your pocket. His vision of the Millicomputer is disruptive. Here's what he has to say.
So I think we'll have a gigabyte or so of RAM in our pocket, 120 gigabytes of storage, something like that. At this point, this isn't a terminal on the end of the network. I want to have a web server running on it. If my machine is a web server that can serve H.264 high-definition video from my pocket over the wireless, right? Then I walk up into a room, and you can already buy these. You can buy Epson. A friend of mine showed me one. It's a video projector. It's got Wi-Fi built into it. You just hook up to it and play. I've got everything in my pocket I need. I don't need services on the web because what I got in my pocket has such big capacity. I go to work, I sit down, my phone says, oh, the thing in my pocket says, my mini computer, says, oh, there's my screen, there's my keyboard, there's my mouse, start working. I get up and go to a meeting, and there's no wires anymore. But this relies on what's in my pocket being a server, not a terminal, not a client.
So the idea is students will be carrying these around, and they'll come into a class, and the projector will be wireless. And so what you'll do is gather everybody, and you'll say, all right, show us what you did when you were gathering data by the riverbank. Show us what you did as you were browsing the stacks in the library. What did you make last night to explain this concept to your colleagues, that is, your fellow students? You've got 2 minutes to do it. You know, it's not PowerPoint anymore. If PowerPoint is the tool to use, use that. But how rich will it be when our students can come in with these, you know, fully multimodal, you know, active learning project summaries and simply share it? The projector knows it's there. The middle computer knows it's there. You just take turns. There you go. At the same time, we have to teach them to be effective just using language in their mouths, right? But I don't think of those things as being mutually exclusive. Craigslist is disruptive. How many of you have used Craigslist or have seen? Okay, right? All right. Reflect on how disruptive this is. There's a great blog post by a guy named Clay Shirky, which I recommend to you. And don't try to copy down the URL unless you're a really fast scribe. Just Google Shirky Newspapers Unthinkable, and you'll find it. I never copy down URLs anymore. I just copy down keywords. And this is what Shirky says. I love this. Imagine in 1996 asking some net-savvy soul to expound on the potential of Craigslist, then a year old and not yet incorporated. The answer you'd almost certainly have gotten would be extrapolation. Mailing lists could be powerful tools. Social effects are intertwining with digital networks, blah, blah, blah. What no one would have told you, could have told you, was what actually happened. Craigslist became a critical part of infrastructure. And what was Craigslist? It was an idea and an understanding of computational thinking. And not even a very deep one at that point, but the idea itself was about people doing their own authoring, about information flowing through and not simply being stored at. And no one could have predicted it. What we could predict is that we couldn't predict it. So Shirky concludes from this, in Craigslist's gradual shift from interesting if minor to essential and transformative, there is one possible answer to the question, if the old model is broken, what will work in its place? The answer is nothing will work, but everything might. And Shirky then says, now is the time for experiments, lots and lots of experiments, each of which will seem as minor at launch as Craigslist did, as Wikipedia did, as Octavo Volumes did. An Octavo Volume is a book that's of a size that's easy to carry around. That's about 550 years old. Who knew? Suddenly, when you can keep the book in your hand, the book changes its character in relation to your life. When Craigslist launched, no one could have known what would have happened. And yet, we know that in a situation of uncertainty, experiment. Lots and lots of experiments. The thing that is both hopeful to me and frustrating to me about higher education is that we should be the kings and queens of experiments. We know how to construct them. We know how to think about them. We know how to pose interesting questions. We know how to evaluate results, sometimes. That's the assessment word. We should be leading the pack in terms of these experiments, but we don't. Here is something that is truly disruptive. Have any of you seen the mother of all funk chords? All right, this is going to be a good thing to kind of drive to the conclusion. This came out early in March. I found out about it when a former student tweeted about it. I could have missed the tweet, but I didn't. I could have gone back and looked for it because it was directed to me with the @GardnerCampbell convention, which Twitter didn't start. It emerged from the users. So a former student, let's peel this onion a little bit. A former student, I'm not grading her anymore. She's back in the past, but we're still in contact. The conversation is ongoing. She knows something about my mind. I know something about hers. She shared this link with me. It came out March 6th. 2 weeks later, the fellow who put this together had been interviewed on NPR, and now what he has created has gone viral, as we say, and has, I think, launched a new genre of musical creativity. To me, it's as exciting as putting the pickups on the block of wood with some strings and then plugging it into an amplifier, which was also disruptive, right? Certainly was disruptive for my parents. Turn that down, Gardner. Turn that down, Gardner. Oh, but I can't get the feedback. Turn that down. So, the mother of all funk chords. I won't tell you exactly what you're seeing. I think you can figure it out as we go along, but we'll talk about it afterwards.
Well, what can I do?
You can play that 16th note groove just straight.
Going.
You'll be amazed.
Okay.
You don't know what it costs me to stop that. It's really difficult. What this fellow did, an Israeli musician who calls himself Kudiman, he went onto YouTube and he found all of these videos done by separate musicians. Some of them, one is a guy practicing his trombone in his living room. One is the guy who's channeling the blues with his harmonica playing and walks in. You know, one is Bernard Purdy doing a drum tutorial. Another is a guy doing the tutorial with the mother of all funk chords. And what Kudiman did was knit them all together into a song. He actually did this for 7 different songs that were just videos he had collected off of YouTube. What's fascinating for me is that no one could have predicted this. No one, who would say, back in 2004, one day there will be millions of videos on YouTube. A lot of them will be music tutorials or people just practicing their instruments. And if you have enough imagination, you can get something together that looks like the song we're all playing together that we don't know we're playing together. The music we're all making together that we don't know we're making together. Yeah.
From this mashup, is the next step that you could go on, look at a YouTube video, say of somebody playing the 9th chord, and webcam yourself playing directly with what you just found?
Why not?
And have that added in?
Why not? Absolutely, you could do that. Sure, you can. This is what Douglas Hofstadter would call an infinitely extensible symbol set. Just like you can make any word you want in English out of 26 characters. Same idea. And in the NPR interview, it was a very good interview, I thought. At the end, the interviewer asked Kudiman, so didn't you kind of miss just making your own music? You know, didn't this kind of rob you of your own creativity? And he sounded puzzled in response. He said, no, this was my creativity too. And he can play an instrument. I think the fact that he was a musician helped him do this. But then he said something that really struck me. He said, now when I play by myself, you know, that's fine, but I kind of miss that spark. I kind of miss that quest to find that next video. My favorite is the little Asian guy who brings the whole band in with his trumpet. That's just beautiful. And if you watch the whole thing, you'll see there's actually a kind of a narrative. Kudiman has gotten the musicians to talk to each other. Then the next question is, of course, did the people complain that you appropriated their stuff? He said, no one's complained yet. He has on the page where these videos, one of the pages where the videos live, they're on YouTube now, so they live everywhere. He's got links to all the original videos. And he said something interesting had happened, though. Some of the people in the videos who didn't know each other had actually gotten together and begun to play. That's an emergent effect. This is disruptive, the laptop, right? Our response to laptops, outright bans, wandering the classroom to monitor what students are doing, always an effective teaching and learning tool, no. And make all, I love this one, make all laptop users sit in the back so that they only distract each other and let them figure out whether their grades are suffering on their own. Just as virtue is its own reward, laptop usage is its own version of hell, purgatory, whatever. Now, does this mean laptop disruption is not something that we have to deal with? I'm not saying that. I'm saying it is disruptive. These are not good ways to deal with disruption. The syllabus. This is a syllabus that I had in graduate school. It has no learning outcomes. It has no weighting for any of the assignments. It has none of the stuff that we think syllabi ought to have. This is from Inside Higher Ed just a few days ago. A good syllabus is the organizing structure of a course. Okay, I'm all right with that. An unambiguous statement of expectations. I think that's oxymoronic. I have expectations. One of them is that the students will surprise me with learning I had not anticipated. Because guess what? I can't anticipate everything they're going to learn. Not if they're authentic learners. Not if they're active learners. And a professor's first line of defense in disputes over policy, procedure, and grades. I love that first line of defense. It sounds like either underarm deodorant or some kind of weapon. And then this one, which truly sends chills up and down my spine. Is this what we have come to? A well-written syllabus functions as a contract between you and your students. If so, it's like a prenuptial agreement. Kind of poisons the relationship to think of it that way, at least in my view. But, you know, there are the elements of learning, your name, the course title, etc. Information is important. If a syllabus is a contract, what have we come to? We're inviting students to think of themselves as coming into a course that has terms of service, and their recourse will be litigation, not the relationship I want to have with learners. And then a professor of English, of course, posted as a comment, as someone who sat on the Great Appeals Committee at a major university for 10 years, I cannot tell you how important it is to have every single thing on your syllabus policy statement. It is a legal binding document. I don't know if a university council would uphold that opinion or not, but it frightens me to think that the thing I hand to my students, the first thing they see about the way I have imagined this experience is a legal binding document intended to be my first line of defense. I'd rather it be an invitation. So let me skip ahead a little bit here and end with this. This is Chris Deedy, who is at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And I often begin with this clip, but I'll end my presentation with it today. You'll hear from what he says that it's a challenge for us to think about the disruptions technology bring as invitations as well. Invitations to a kind of personalization, a way of shaping metacognition, making the experience of learning something other than a bunch of buckets in a room and a better machine to fill the buckets. So I will let Chris Deedy have the last word, and I hope that it speaks to you.
Our assumptions about learning are fundamentally flawed. I want to describe three kinds of common human behaviors and put them on a continuum from simple to complex: sleeping, eating, and bonding. People are pretty much alike in the way that they sleep. If you're designing hotel rooms, it's pretty easy to create a hotel room that works for anybody across any culture in terms of what they need to sleep. Eating is much more variable. People like to eat very different things, and they like to eat them in very different ways. They like the eating experience to be quite different. So if you're designing a restaurant, not just the architecture, but the menu and the style of dining that goes on, there's incredible variety. Bonding is more complex still. People bond to pets. People bond to sports teams. People bond to people who are like them, who are opposite to them. They bond sexually. They bond platonically. They bond to groups. People who study bonding are struck by how incredibly rich and varied it is. We treat learning like sleeping. But everything we know about learning suggests that it's like bonding, or at least like eating. And yet the very, very best of our high-end learning environments have less variety than a bad fast food restaurant.
So thanks very much for your kind attention and participation. I know it's time for a break now, so...
Do
we have some time for questions? Great. Okay. Be happy to entertain questions.
I can help you. How do you bond with 100 or 150 students, especially online?
Yeah, that's a great, great question, and it's one that comes up. What do you do with a very, very large class? The answer is, it would be nice if we didn't have large classes. I think there are ways in which we have so made learning like sleeping that we have fooled ourselves into thinking that if only the person at the front of the room has a good enough PA and a PowerPoint presentation, it doesn't matter whether there are six people or 6,000 in the room. I just don't think that's true. However, there is a bit of a silver lining with some of these technologies in that if you can't bond with every single person in a section of 150 or 200, the online affordances will make it possible for them to find each other and bond with each other, which is really the thing that matters most of all, in ways that we couldn't have before. What has to happen is the environment has to be set up in a way that they feel they have a stake in it, that their authorship is authentic, and that they are worth discovering. Now, Facebook knows how to do that, right? Blackboard does not. I just have to say this. Most of the learning management systems I'm familiar with, I would say all, except that's a total statement, and I'd have to go check. But certainly Blackboard, the one I'm most familiar with, would think of things like usernames, avatars where you can put a graphical representation of identity up, little SIG files where you have a little quote that you like, all the little things that we do to personalize this information space. They think of that as irrelevant. It doesn't matter because it's not about conveying information. Au contraire, it conveys a vital piece of information, that whatever you're reading emerges from a particular person, matters to that person, and bears the trace of their identity and personality. We subscribe in the end not to information but to each other. That's why this is important. So some of these tools can actually scale the experience of community. The gold standard for me in this regard is the work that a fellow named Michael Wesch does. Some of you may have run across some of his resources. If you haven't, I commend him to you. He's a professor at Kansas State University. The Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching last year named him Research Professor of the Year. He is someone who has used these tools in remarkably imaginative ways in large enrollment classes to get students engaged with each other as learners in ways that are visible, in ways that actually catalyze further participation and buy-in. So his last name is Wesch, W-E-S-C-H. He has put many videos up on YouTube. The first one that came out was called The Machine is Using Us, Web 2.0 in 5 minutes. His story of how he put that out the Friday, I think, before Super Bowl weekend and then watched it go viral over the next month or so is quite remarkable. It's had millions and millions of views. I would also recommend to you A Portal to Media Literacy. That's up on YouTube as well, and that's where he describes some of the experiments he's done with his students to try to get a large enrollment class to feel that they are a community. I blogged about this once and tried to frame it in terms of making a community into a culture. It's hard to think of a 200 or 300 person class as a community, but we can easily think about it as a culture. And cultures are made of communities. That's one way we experience that scaling. And I think Mike Wesch has really pushed out in that direction better than anyone. So very inspiring fellow. I commend his work to you. Other questions?
We'll have some more time with you
good.
At the end.
Okay. Thank you.